your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN. The wake-up call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel, serving the Charlottesville area with home heating oil and propane and famous Exxon gasolines. The wake-up call is also brought to you by The Hook, an innovative weekly from the people who really know the news on Newsstands Thursday. Now with your host, Rick Moore.
Oh, welcome, boys and girls. Another lovely Sunday here on the Wake Up Call with WNRN, the 23rd, according to all my notes. I hope you're here with me. Well, if you're listening, I guess you are. Thanks for joining in. A mighty interesting and important topic lined up for the hour. We have everybody in the studio. The topic today involves a little chaos between Lebanon and Israel, and as one of my guests suggested, having how many people we have in here? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. There's a number 6 outside, 7 counting Mr. Reynolds. We had 8 and 9 counting Isabel and Fran. We have chaos here in the studio, so that really sets us off to the right start. We do have, let me fire up everyone's microphone, Professor Daniel Lefkowitz here. Professor, how are you?
Very good, thanks.
Thanks for coming in today.
My pleasure.
And your specialty, you are from the anthropology department, correct?
Well, I'm actually in anthropology and the Middle East studies, and my specialty was Israel, as well as linguistics and anthropology, sure.
So I invited you on today because of your cultural view on the Mideast. Thanks for being here. A lot of folks don't like to give up their Sundays. We also have Professor David Waldner here, from the political side of things, and what's your expertise?
Well, I teach in the university's political science department. I write on economic development and democratization, but anybody who specializes in the domestic politics and development of Middle Eastern countries has to know an awful lot and care an awful lot about international relations, United States foreign policy, and viciously violent conflict.
Which sort of leads us right into what we're talking about today. The topic today is Lebanon and Israel, sort of the current events that are going on there. But a lot of it is how we got from there to here. Let's start with sort of the basic news. I always like to assume that my smart listeners know what's going on, but let's lay a little groundwork for everyone so that we're all working from the same page. Everything, all the articles that I've read are blaming Hezbollah, the militant group from Lebanon, for starting this by kidnapping two Israeli soldiers and killing 8 others when they came across the border. Is that truly the beginning of the current battle? I don't want to go back 30 years and so on and say, well, it really all starts here. But for what's happening in the last week or two, is that a fair call from what the media is telling us of what started this battle?
Yes, absolutely. If you just want to look at the most recent events, it was on July 12th, so about 10, 11 days ago now, that Hezbollah had a fairly well-planned operation. It began with a bombardment of some positions, Israeli positions across the border, and then their units went across and killed a few Israeli soldiers and captured 2 others and took them back into Lebanon. The only context I'd give you for current events is that this was not the first time Hezbollah has done this. They had tried this most recently back in November of 2005, and there had been various cross-border exchanges between Israel and Hezbollah since the Israeli army withdrew from South Lebanon in May of 2000. And I think that's worth pointing out because my guess is that the Hezbollah leaders, particularly Sheikh Nasrallah, who initiated this operation, believe that Israel would respond similarly to the way it responded in the past, which is not to massively escalate. On the contrary to that forecast, the Israeli government under Olmert did decide that this time Hezbollah had crossed some sort of line, or that Israeli politics had changed enough to require a larger response. So Israel began to shell southern Lebanon. Hezbollah responded with firing some of its thousands of rockets into Israeli positions and Israeli cities. And that's how we got to where we are today.
Why would Hezbollah cross the border? What would get them to do that without being provoked? Why did they go first?
The stated objective here is that Israel still holds some Lebanese nationals prisoner and that Hezbollah wanted to kidnap some Israeli soldiers and use them in a prisoner exchange. They had done that in the past, capturing some Israelis in October of 2000, I think, and there was a prisoner exchange in 2004. So the stated objective is to do that one more time. I suspect the larger issue here is that ever since what's been called the Cedar Revolution of the spring of 2005, at which time the Syrian army was forced to withdraw from Lebanon, the U.S. and others have been pushing the Lebanese political system to fulfill all the terms of U.N. Security Council Resolution 1559 of September 2004, which calls for the demilitarization of Hezbollah and for the Lebanese army to take control of the southern border with Israel. That pressure had increased recently. I think Hezbollah was saying, if you put pressure on us to demilitarize, we'll show you what we can do, and hence we see this action. But there had been a chain of exchanges between Israeli forces and Hezbollah ever since May 2004. In that respect, this is not unusual. It's the escalation that is unusual.
Professor Lefkowitz, all the articles I've read over the past week or so, whoever the reporters are talking with, if they're speaking with an Israeli, the Israeli says, I don't care how many people have died in Lebanon. I don't care what's going on over there. The Israelis' military needs to react as strongly as possible to make the Lebanese pay. And if they speak with someone from Lebanon, they say, the Israelis have, you know, been attacking us and been bothering us and always had their nose in our things forever. The Lebanese have every right to do what they're doing. Why is there so much cultural hate? It can't all be based on religion, is it?
Oh, no. In fact, I would think, if anything, I would tend to turn that around on its head and say that, in fact, religion is used as a symbol of the conflict, a kind of rallying point. It becomes an enormously powerful one, both on a personal level and on a politically political rhetorical level. But no, I tend not to think of it as a religious, but rather as a political, military, social, and cultural conflict. But you're right. You actually framed this whole discussion very aptly when you said, well, you know, we'd like some background, some historical background to these most recent events, but it is very difficult to know where to begin that kind of historical background. And David went back just a couple of years in that trajectory, but of course one could go much, much further. There's a long history of conflict with Lebanon. There's a long history of conflict that involves the Israeli state or even the Jewish settlement before the emergence of the state. So it's really been quite an amazing history of conflict, of attack and counterattack and blame and counterblame. It really is. There is such a long and involved and complex history that it makes it very difficult to know where to get into the discussion. And certainly each side in this conflict, although I really hesitate to think of it as two sides, it's really quite a complex conflict. But each side certainly sees their own victimization and likes to represent themselves as victims. And that is one of the things that drives the rhetoric of this conflict very powerfully.
All right. It is 11:10 here on the Wake Up Call, and we are talking with Professor David Waldner and Professor Daniel Lefkowitz, both from the University of Virginia, as we speak and discuss Lebanon and Israel. Hezbollah, and again, a lot of this I'm sort of playing the dumb guy because, you know, I read the articles and I watch The Daily Show with Jon Stewart, and, you know, that's about it because I don't get home in time to watch the evening news. And it just a lot of it to me is so one-sided it doesn't matter anyway. Hezbollah is a part of Lebanon. Lebanon doesn't have the domestic scene that we see here in the United States, correct? There are multiple groups, multiple factions making up the Lebanese government, correct?
That's correct, and it's worth pointing out that Hezbollah sits in the Lebanese parliament and has cabinet ministers. They're a part of the democratic electoral scene and political scene in Lebanon.
But they're not anywhere close to being the major scene, right? I thought I read that it was something like 20-plus seats and 120-plus seat parliament.
In alliance with another group that represents Lebanese Shi'i Muslims, they have, I believe, 28 seats out of 128. But that's the Lebanese electoral system is designed to give a quota to different sectarian groups, and that quota in principle represents their proportion within the overall population. But as a result of that, the politicization of demographics, there's been no census in Lebanon for about 70 years. So Christians get 64, or one-half, the seats in parliament, which vastly overstates their proportion of the population. If there were true representation, Hezbollah would probably have, I would think, closer to 40 seats.
But even still, that's only a third, and I'm just curious as to how such a minority faction can do such a countrywide event and not be stopped by the rest of the country and the other groups.
Lebanon had a vicious civil war that roughly lasted between 1975 and 1990, and Hezbollah was established in the middle of that civil war. At the conclusion of the civil war, many of the parties, many of the militias, which were largely private militias, largely demilitarized, largely broke apart their military wings. Not completely, but largely so. Hezbollah did not, in part because they were fighting the Israeli occupation in the south, in part because they had the support and sponsorship of Syria, which had an occupying force in Lebanon. And so in the south and in southern parts of Beirut, Hezbollah is not just a political wing, but a military wing. And it appears that it would be very difficult for other parties in Lebanon to disarm and demilitarize Hezbollah without perhaps launching the country back towards civil war, which people are understandably loath to do.
So there is no leader in Lebanon. No part of the government can control Hezbollah, which is currently sort of creating all the, or at least from what most people say, is the reason that all this damage is happening elsewhere in the country?
There is a president, there is a prime minister, there's a speaker of parliament, but each person represents a sectarian group, and these different sectarian groups have a history of sometimes being in conflict with one another, sometimes cooperating. There's a Lebanese army of about 60,000 soldiers. About half of them are themselves Shi'i, which means they share some cultural background with Hezbollah and might not want to participate in disarming Hezbollah. It is the Israeli position that the Lebanese state and the Lebanese army could disarm Hezbollah, but just have not had the will to do so. And part of the Israeli strategy is to raise the cost for Lebanon as a whole of not disarming and demobilizing Hezbollah. But that has not yet worked. And it's, I think, fair to say it would be very difficult for any Lebanese group to disarm Hezbollah without a great deal of outside support.
Speaking of outside support, Hezbollah is knowingly supported by other countries, correct? Syria and Iran.
That's correct.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Was this done, was this attack done with the support of Syria and Iran? Was it done so in hopes of spreading into a greater war?
There's a great deal of speculation about that. I do not believe we know the facts, but here is how I would reason about it. Yes, Iran and Syria have supported Hezbollah financially, politically, and importantly, militarily. They've helped to train Hezbollah forces. They've helped to supply Hezbollah with these various weapon systems. Yes, Syria and Iran are both benefiting quite handsomely in some respects from this crisis. Syria is benefiting because after being forced to withdraw from Lebanon a year ago, and this was in large part at the urging of the Bush administration now knows that Syria has to come back and play some sort of role. They're talking about that now. Iran is benefiting because 2 weeks ago, we were talking about UN Security Council resolutions and other international efforts to stop the Iranian program of uranium enrichment, which might have led to Iran developing nuclear weapons, and no one's talking about that right now. So in that sense, Iran and Syria have benefited. But I would say countering that, A, Hezbollah is not just a puppet, it's not just a facade, it's not just doing the bidding of its masters in Damascus and Tehran. Hezbollah is a large organization with perhaps hundreds of thousands of Lebanese citizens supporting it. It has its own financial and military and political resources. And B, I don't think anyone could have foreseen that the original Hezbollah operation that kidnapped the two Israeli soldiers would have led to this sort of crisis. I think it was just as reasonable to say Israel might do some small-scale shelling, but that there won't be a massive retaliation. I think Hezbollah thought that Israel was, in a sense, distracted, and Dan can speak more about this, distracted by what's happening in the Gaza Strip, and that there wouldn't be a large-scale response and escalation. And had there been no large-scale escalation, then Syria and Iran would not have benefited from it at all. There'd be nothing to benefit from. So it's not certain at all to me. And if I had a bet, I would say Iran and Syria were not behind this.
We are here on the wake-up call, speaking with Professor David Waldner, Professor Daniel Lefkowitz, about Lebanon and Israel. Professor Lefkowitz, why did Israel respond differently, take a major reply rather than some of the more minor ones that people thought they might, like in the past?
Right, that's the great question. I think, again, there's a lot of speculation in the media. There's a lot of comments in the Israeli as well as the international media, some comments from Israeli political figures. I think one of the big things to consider is the Israeli, the need that Israeli government and military perceived to reclaim a certain deterrence factor. And so we were talking about where in the history, long history of this overall conflict to begin our discussion. There has been a long history of sort of tit-for-tat small border incursions, especially since the Israeli withdrawal from the southern part of Lebanon about 5 years ago, and Hezbollah has been fairly active in that, and there has been one of the rhetorical devices, at least, that Hezbollah has used to justify and legitimize its attacks against the Israeli military outposts in the north of Israel over the past 4 or 5 years has been a claim on a small strip of land called the Shabbat Farms, which Israel is very complicated history to that, but Israel believes that it is not part of Lebanon, but rather originally part of Syria, part of the Israeli-occupied Golan Heights that Israel conquered in 1967. Hezbollah has made a very strong claim that small strip of land should have been returned to Lebanon when the Israeli army withdrew from southern Lebanon, from all other territories it occupied in southern Lebanon. So that was a sort of excuse for a long series of relatively low-level incursions and rocket attacks and conflict. And in that history, as David was saying, there had been 4 or 5 years of relatively minor Hezbollah rocket attacks, followed by, again, relatively minor Israeli responses, bombings of Hezbollah positions, etc.
So what cranks it up?
Again, I think one of the things to consider is the need, the Israeli perception that not just going back to this history with Hezbollah, but also perhaps 15 years to the Gulf War, in 1990-1991, when Israel was attacked by Iraqi Scud missiles. Again, as we see here, frankly, the scale of damage that was done to Israel, the number of casualties suffered by Israel was relatively minor, but it, as a cultural matter, I suppose, it was a major attack on Israel. And the Israeli response at that time, under strong pressure from the coalition forces, including primarily the United States, again, this is 1990, was not to respond militarily, but to allow the Scud missiles to land on Israeli territory and do some damage without responding militarily, and that went against the grain of Israeli military history and Israeli cultural history. Since the establishment of Israel, there had always been a tradition of very, very strong response with what they call the deterrence. And in fact, this brings up all sorts of other issues. The overall deterrence that Israel has always relied on is, of course, its unacknowledged but widely known nuclear power. And I think, I think that is part of the story about this massive retaliation to a relatively minor offense, that it was an effort to reclaim a position in the Middle East whereby even small infractions, infringements on its sovereignty would be responded to by overwhelming force.
All right, 11:22 here on the Wake Up Call. We want to thank the markets of Tiger Fuel Forecast for Central Virginia and the Shenandoah Valley. Partly cloudy with a chance of showers and thunderstorms today. High 75 to 80, partly cloudy, then clearing tonight. Lows 60 to 65, mostly sunny tomorrow. Highs 80 to 85, partly cloudy in the valley and 75, partly cloudy in Lynchburg and 73. Cloudy in Richmond and 75. In Charlottesville, mostly clear and 76.
You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call, brought to you by The Hook and by the markets of Tiger Fuel, a refreshing pause on your journey to anywhere with locations all over town. Now back to your host, Rick Moore.
And let's take a moment to thank Blue Ridge Graphics for their support today. You can find them at the corner of Meade Avenue and East High Street in Charlottesville, providing custom T-shirts and sportswear, plus promotional items for schools, organizations, and businesses. That's Blue Ridge Graphics. 296-9746. And aside from the Blue Ridge Graphics, we want to thank our listeners, because there's only one station that brings you programs like the Wake Up Call, and the only reason we can do this is because of listeners like Patrick Eck, the Farinos, and Jill Green, all who supported us in the Spring Fund Drive. It's also because of our program underwriters like the ones you're hearing from this hour, as well as Settle Tire and Eloise. So stay tuned and tell a friend about the Wake Up Call, another programming you enjoy on WNRN. And be sure to support us during the Fall Fund Drive. Professor Lefkowitz, you had a comment you wanted to make?
Yeah, just to add some comments about other factors in this massive response to a relatively minor incursion. One is that the sort of logic to the Israeli withdrawal 4 or 5 years ago from Gaza, and of course this logic is continuing. Another thing that I wanted to mention was that the Lebanon incident that we're discussing is not happening in isolation, but rather it's tied very closely to what was happening, what preceded it, and continues to happen in Gaza, where there's, again, a very, very similar set of circumstances that, again, set off a relatively massive Israeli incursion there, response. So one of the things is that the relatively new Israeli strategy in dealing with the conflict has been, it goes by a number of different names, but basically a unilateralist withdrawal, a withdrawal of Israeli troops from occupied territories, whether southern Lebanon 5 or 6 years ago, or the Gaza just last year, or the anticipated withdrawal from much of the West Bank that was the platform of the newest Israeli government. This is all the strategy, or part of this, the theory behind this, is to essentially, instead of taking responsibility, having the Israeli military be responsible for maintaining peace in places where there's a lot of resistance to Israel and to Israeli policies, if not Israeli occupation specifically, to withdraw from these occupied territories and create certain an appearance, at least, of a sovereign entity that then can be blamed for any disruptions of the peace. And I think that's what we see here, is that the massive retaliation that Israel has brought against Lebanon is in part justified, and here you see the international, essentially the acceptance internationally of what Israel is doing. Part of the reason there is that Lebanon as a sovereign entity without an occupation in the southern part can be held responsible for the actions of the Hezbollah, the military, the militia, in ways that when Israel was occupying that territory, they couldn't have been. And you see a similar effect in Gaza, where I think the Israeli withdrawal from Gaza has allowed a stronger Israeli response to certain attacks than would have been sanctioned, than occurred by and large while Israel was occupying Gaza, and would have been sanctioned by the international and Arab communities more broadly. There are other things. There's an Israeli political issue. The current Israeli prime minister, the new government, is led by a prime minister and a defense minister, both of whom are relatively inexperienced, both in their positions, but also specifically militarily. I think in part there was a need, given the leadership that was militarily inexperienced without the military reputation and stature, there was a certain push to a stronger response than might otherwise have been necessary. And finally, the international support, at least the American support. I think Israel almost certainly went into the response in Lebanon, assuming that it would be a few days. I think that Israelis are as surprised as anybody that the international community has sort of allowed, if not, certainly allowed Israel to continue for 10 days, probably now for another week or so.
Let's toss out the phone lines in case you want to call in. Please do. Questions, comments, all here for Professor Daniel Lefkowitz, Professor David Waldner, both from the University of Virginia, as we talk about Lebanon and Israel. The local line, 979-0919. The toll-free line, maybe you're listening on the new Harrisonburg 95.1, 1-877-WNRN-ROCKS. That is toll-free, 1-877-WNRN-ROCKS, 979-0919 for the local folks. I get everybody out in the lobby to answer your call and patch you through. Catherine, Michael, Jeff, Tim, so dial us in. Daniel, you mentioned sort of the world, everyone else approving, even maybe quietly approving what's going on. One of the things that that caught my attention with everything that was going on in Iraq, our administration said, we have to go in and stop this. This can't happen. With everything that was going on in North Korea, we said, well, let's try diplomacy and see if that works. With everything that's going on with Lebanon and Israel, we haven't done squat. So what's that all about? Is that because the Israeli or the Jewish play such a big part in American politics? Is that because we're so diplomatically tied with Israel? I mean, why?
Well, another very good question. Certainly the American Jewish lobby that gained a lot of attention lately with the publication of a very provocative article recently is an enormously powerful lobby, has a very strong position that it asserts very effectively, much as the gun lobby and other lobbies do. I tend to think that a singular focus on the effect of the lobby really mistakes the more significant thing about why policies tend to be aligned in certain ways. One of the things, and of course here too, the question almost sort of could be turned around. Israel is sort of banking on, drawing on, if you will, the its ability to claim its role as a sort of surrogate America, fighting the same kinds of forces of, if you will, Muslim fundamentalism or irrationality.
So they're hoping it's a war on terror and Americans will come in and pick a side? Is that what you're saying?
Well, they certainly have been very actively constructing it as a war on terror, and the Americans certainly have been very supportive of that, sure.
Professor Waldner, what's your take on it? And why do we, and I don't want to get into Iraq and I don't want to get into North Korea, but we've approached each of these three things so differently, and I have no doubt that, you know, the fine details are different and require their own introspection. But what makes this current issue with Israel and Lebanon so different that we don't, that we kind of sit back and don't do anything? I mean, Condoleezza Rice hasn't even gone over there yet, has she?
Condoleezza Rice is scheduled to leave sometime today or tomorrow to go to
Israel. But this started happening, you said, on the 11th or 12th.
I wouldn't say that the U.S. hasn't done anything here. We have, for example, resupplied Israel with precision munitions. We have said that Israel can do this. We've given it a green light. We've supported the Israeli actions. We've put some conditions on Israeli actions saying that we don't want to cause undue harm to Lebanese civilians. I'm not really sure what the threshold is between due harm and undue harm. And we've also asked that the government of Fouad Sinjar, who's actually in some respects an ally of ours and we have supported in the past, not be unduly harmed by this. We haven't acted more directly because we don't have to. I mean the Bush administration here, likes what Israel is doing. The Bush administration identified an axis of evil, of which the westernmost two-thirds were Iran and Syria. Hezbollah is seen as the local tool, if you will, of Iran and Syria. And so when Israel tries to beat up on Hezbollah, we say, go do it, because you're doing exactly what we would want.
Hey, we're fighting the war over there.
Yeah.
Through someone else.
Yeah, exactly. Now, mind you, there are voices in the American political scene that would like us to be more directly involved. Bill Kristol, who's the editor of the Weekly Standard, an important intellectual on the neoconservative side of American politics, has called for the U.S. to start bombing Syria. That's not likely to happen. In fact, it seems quite clear that Syria is going to be called in somehow. And I say somehow because we don't have any diplomatic relations with Syria right now, so we can't speak to them directly. Somehow Syria is going to be asked to help defuse the situation. I'm not sure the Syrians will accede to that request, since they're actually in the driver's seat right now. The Syrians might overplay their hand, and we might eventually decide to get even tougher with them. But by and large, we like what Israel is doing. There may be concerns about the humanitarian costs of it, which, and they are huge. We haven't talked about that yet. There may be some growing sense that, maybe the Israelis aren't quite in control of the situation on the ground. This strategy is not going to work. I think that's probably correct. So we'll be more and more active. But look, this administration has been remarkably passive in the Middle East compared to six or seven of its predecessors. And we've only now seen it mobilize. But at the end of the day, I would say the administration doesn't really know what to do.
Well, and I think also, I mean, for the sake of an hour's discussion, it's reasonable to limit it to Lebanon. But the crisis is so incredibly involved with the much broader pictures of Iraq, what America is doing in Iraq, and other issues. Much of what has happened is a result of a number of years now of the Bush administration's various policies, where they are, as you wonderfully put it, incredibly involved in certain aspects of it and incredibly disengaged from other aspects of it. And the management of the Israeli-Arab crisis for the past 50 years has depended very heavily on involvement of America, U.S., and other European powers, but primarily recently the United States, as a way of pushing slowly, certainly, but pushing towards compromise and stability, at least. And in the past 6 years, the Bush administration has really withdrawn from that effort, and I think very drastic things have happened as a result.
Let me take a moment and thank Five Guys Burgers and Fries for their support today. They're Seville Reader's Choice for Burgers and rated by a Zagat Restaurant Survey for 4 years running. Five Guys serves America's standard, fresh and handmade, 11 a.m. to 9 p.m., and they're open until 10 on Fridays and Saturdays. Five Guys Burgers and Fries is behind the fountain in the Barracks Road Shopping Center and now open in the Hollymead Town Center and on the Downtown Mall here in Charlottesville. You can reach them at 975-GUYS. All right, back to the topic at hand, Lebanon and Israel, with Professor David Waldner from the UVA Department of Political Science and Professor Daniel Lefkowitz, I've already forgotten where you're from, but a UVA specialist. I have you listed down here as a specialist in the anthropology department on Mideast cultures.
That's right.
But you gave me a much more wordy topic that I didn't write down at the time.
Anthropology is fine.
Anthropology, university professor, knows what the hell you're talking about, which is really why you're here today during the hour. 979-0919 if you want to ask a question of your own and not let me ask all the questions. 1-877-WNRN-ROCKS if you need to use a toll-free line and save some long-distance bill. Is this really a... I mean, obviously we need to be concerned about it because we have 25,000 Americans in Lebanon, and there's the topic about whether or not it's going to spread to become a regional war. But each of you, let me know, based on your expertise, is this just another sort of issue in the, you know, roller coaster that goes on between Israel and the other you know, area countries? Or is this like, whoa, this is more serious than we've seen in quite some time?
Well, I'll go first. There's a lot of commentary. I tend to take a long view, and it is, you know, the last 50 years is just a remarkable roller coaster of crises and diffused crises and wars, and certainly the Israeli incursion into Lebanon right now is very reminiscent of what happened 1982, about 20 years ago. When Israel first conquered the southern part of Lebanon and held on to a significant portion of the southern part of Lebanon for 20 years. There's a tremendous amount of rehashing of old events. Each time it takes a slightly different form. Each time, I suppose, because munitions get to be more powerful and perhaps, I don't know. There are other lots of factors that the introduction of missile technology, for instance, has really changed a number of things in this conflict. There are certainly a lot of commentators out there who are claiming that this is the dawn of a very, very new era in the Middle East conflicts. One of the things is the sort of realignment of the Arab world that David, or potential realignment, David could probably talk about. I tend to think, yes, that this is another blip on the, essentially the same trajectory, that essentially the same underlying issues of military, economic power, political power between the West and the Middle East, between Israel and its neighbors, the issue of self-determination for Palestinians, in the region occupied by Israel and Palestine, and the meaning that conflict has in the broader Arab and Muslim world, that these are essentially more of the same.
I would like to start by saying we should care because there's a looming humanitarian crisis. Figures are very hard to come by and very hard to verify, but we hear numbers now of upwards of 500,000 people being displaced from the south. We know that Israel is... right now does not seem to be contemplating a large-scale ground incursion, but they've basically told the Lebanese population south of the Litani River to go away, to get out. And that's going to create all sorts of problems on the line, and I think we have some sort of ethical obligation to, if not stop that displacement, certainly ease the suffering of those who are displaced. And let's remember that a year ago, during the Cedar Revolution in Lebanon, when hundreds of thousands of Lebanese came out on the streets to call for the withdrawal of Syrian forces and the return of Lebanese sovereignty, we supported them. The Bush administration called this a huge victory. We were proud of this, the March of Freedom. These same people are suffering now, and we are literally doing nothing. And that is awful. That is revolting. I agree with Dan Lefkowitz that we're not seeing something in terms of a huge change in regional dynamics. There are some trends we could speak about, and perhaps we'll have a chance to do so. But the idea that there'll be some broader war right now strikes me as being fantastical. The Syrians are not acting in any provocative way. The Iranians are keeping their heads down. Israel has made it clear they don't want to enlarge the scope of the conflict. So these headlines we get, Middle East on the brink, they're silly. But let's talk about one more thing that the U.S. could care about and Americans could care about, which is the broader confrontation between the U.S. and radical Islamic groups that are not tied to any particular national territory. And I mean here largely al-Qaeda, which is quite distinct in important ways from either Hamas in Palestine or Hezbollah. let's visualize, if we can, yesterday's front page of the New York Times. On one half of the front page was a picture out of a southern Lebanese city of Tsour, I believe it was, and it was a row of coffins. With numbers next to them, we could see coffins 28 through 35, and though the headlines didn't mention it, the first few coffins were a family. You could read the names on the coffins, and the coffin to the right was of a small child. So that's one picture. Next to that is the story that the U.S. is expediting the rearmament of Israel with precision munitions, the same munitions which have killed those people. Leave aside the ethical issues of that right there. How does that play within the broader Islamic world? It plays that the U.S. helps Israel kill Muslim children. And that's the image that's going to go out to millions of young men. And a small portion of those young men will be sufficiently alienated from their own communities and sufficiently enraged and sufficiently willing to use violence that they will join some version of Al-Qaeda. And that helps keep it alive.
All right. Let's take a call. Jerry, are you there?
Yes.
Can you hang on just a second?
Certainly.
I got business work to do, and okay. I will be right back with you.
All right.
All right, 11:41 here on the Wake Up Call.
You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call, brought to you by the Markins of Tiger Fuel and by The Hook, an innovative weekly on newsstands every Thursday. Now here's Rick with what you can find in this week's Hook.
Oh, this week the UVA Medical Center has been placed on probation by a national accrediting agency. Is this a small concern or possible doom for the hospital? Merchants and shoppers wonder how the higher parking prices will affect Charlottesville's downtown mall. And the parents discuss the evidence that helped convict their son of planning to bomb local schools. The Hook. Alcohol, gratuity, and taxes not included. And Blue Ridge Mountain Sports, they are featuring a wide selection of camping and backpacking gear. Blue Ridge is also your headquarters for outdoor footwear. The experts at Blue Ridge can help you get the most out of your summer outdoors. Blue Ridge Mountain Sports is in the Barracks Road Shopping Center, Charlottesville, the Mountain Inn at Wintergreen. They're in Richmond and at brms.com. And hang tight, I know you won't go anywhere because at noon, George Bell will be here for Les Temps Purdue, the best of 80s and 90s alternative. There's no Aldo Nova, Kinks, Michael Jackson, but you will hear Hoodoo Guru, Sublime, and Frankie Goes to Hollywood. He always likes requests as well. Les Temps Purdue, brought to you in part by Plan 9 Music, only on WNRN. All right, let's see if I can get my headphones to work properly and take a call from Jerry down in Lynchburg. Hey, Jerry.
Hi there. I truly believe that the future of the world and my children's and grandchildren's lives depend upon the people of the United States taking a stand. First of all, standing up for peace immediately. The lives of hundreds of thousands of people are at stake, possibly millions. It's my belief that the government of Israel is holding 4 million people hostage in Lebanon. And I think facts and the truth about the situation never disseminate to the American public. If you listen to the BBC's version of events on the ground, you'll hear something completely different from CNN's version. I would like more discussion about the 80 to 100 nuclear bombs that Israel has, aimed at, apparently, destinations in Europe, not least the cities in the country where I'm from. I would also like some discussion of the 60th anniversary of the King David's Hotel massacre, which was a massacre perpetrated by Jewish terrorists against British and Palestinians in a hotel in Jerusalem in 1947, 46, it was 60th anniversary. There was also a letter bomb campaign against British military policemen's families in the 1940s, late 40s, during the troubles in Palestine.
All right, Jerry, let's let these guys comment back at you.
Blown off by a Jewish letter bomb.
Yeah. And, all right, Jerry. I need these guys to come. They can't talk. I'm sorry, Jerry, but you know you got to let the ghosts. You got to let the guests actually have something to say. All right. Let's start with Professor Waldner, and again, I don't like to cut off the guests, but, you know, You can't ask but so many questions before the guests have an opportunity to reply. Professor Waldner, what about all the nuclear bombs? Is that true? First of all, for the average American, is that true that Israel has 80 to 100 nuclear bombs? Who knows?
Israel certainly has a very powerful nuclear arsenal. I guess we have, 100,000 or 20,000? I have no idea. I don't count nuclear bombs. They certainly have a very potent arsenal and have for a couple decades. As to where they're pointed, I can't say. I have no idea.
It strikes me as slightly fantastical to believe that they're pointed at European cities. And from what I know about guidance systems, you don't literally point them, and these are the sorts of things that can be changed fairly rapidly given modern communication systems, etc. Let's not kid ourselves. Prior to the State of Israel, there were Zionist groups that used terror tactics, and the focus of many of those terror tactics were Palestinians, and the focus of many of them were British colonial officers.
And the leaders of many of those terrorist groups became prime minister.
Yeah. I don't want to give Israel this sort of clean bill of ethical health. It's engaged in some questionable tactics. On the other hand, if you're worried about what the U.S. is doing in the world, one of the reasons the U.S. attracts certain types of aggressive actions, terrorist actions, etc., are because it's out there in the world intervening in other people's lives in a way that other people don't see as legitimate, which, forgive me if you're saying it, but that's what Britain was doing. Britain was the colonial master in the post-World War II period. People under colonial rule said, we don't like being ruled by the British anymore. And when the British moved too slowly to disengage, force was used against them. It's a terrible toll on people's lives, but if you're worried about peace, you can't worry about what America's doing in the world right now and then go back and look at what Britain was doing 50, 60 years ago and act as if this was solely innocent.
All right, we got another call.
We got Daniel from Forest.
Got Daniel from Forest. Hey, Daniel.
Hey, how's it going, guys? My question is regards to what the professor said about Syria's withdrawal from Lebanon. Do you think that Iran's support of Hezbollah has something to do with America being so lax in our going in and offering the Lebanese help because of the large amounts of money and arms that Hezbollah is getting from Iran, so we can show we are trying to truly isolate Iran in this nuclear standoff? And just what y'all's thoughts are about that.
All right. Do me one favor. Professor Waldner couldn't hear much of that. Break that down into an eight-word question.
I heard a question about Syria and Lebanon, and then my headphones went out. I have new headphones now, so.
Well, basically, is the U.S., by not getting too much into it, trying to isolate Iran more into the Lebanon conflict?
All right, thanks, Daniel. We'll get on that.
Thank you.
There is no doubt that the overall U.S. goal is to minimize the capacity of Iran to project power throughout the region, and more specifically to prevent Syria from exercising any authority within Lebanon as a whole. And destroying Hezbollah is the primary way of doing that, because Iran primarily has influence in Lebanon because of Hezbollah. Syria had more direct influence in Lebanon because it had 14,000 security forces and troops in the country, and it had essentially was able to control the government. That sort of authority has ended, and that was the first step. And so, again, destroying Hezbollah is very important to the U.S. But the Syrians and the Iranians are not passively waiting around to watch this happen. And, look, it does see, you might recall 4 or 5 days ago there was this taped conversation of President Bush when he spoke off the cuff, shall we say, in colorful language. And most commentators in America, being culturally Puritans, wanted to focus on the fact that he used a four-letter expletive, which was I could care less about. What's really important was what he said: someone needs to get the Syrians to take care of things for us. And that's precisely what the Syrians want. Again, it doesn't mean that they directly conducted the course of these operations, but the Syrians could go back in principle and reimpose some sort of stability on that frontier. So America is kind of stuck. On the one hand, it wants to minimize Syrian authority. On the other hand, it needs the Syrians. And it's not clear yet how that is going to play out. Uh, In terms of Iran, we don't yet have what I understand to be a clear and coherent and forceful policy vis-a-vis Iran. What the U.S. is always concerned about is that if it enters into negotiations with a country like Iran, then Iran can claim some sort of major diplomatic victory, which will just make it hungry for more victories and in a sense, impel it to become even more confrontational and aggressive. The problem, though, is that we don't speak to Iran right now directly. We don't speak to Syria directly. We don't speak to Hezbollah directly. We don't speak to Hamas directly. This is rather astonishing. The key players in the conflict right now are people we don't speak to, because this administration believes that diplomacy is for the weak, that you need to be muscular. What's happening now is the Bush administration has figured out that force doesn't win everything. Sometimes you need diplomacy. They're slowly moving away from this much more muscular, aggressive, hit them hard and see what happens, let the chips fall where they may, if you will. And they're saying we need to get in there and engage various groups and see if we could use diplomacy to settle some of these conflicts. But again, they don't have diplomatic relations. And you go back. In 1973, Israel and Syria fought a huge war. I mean, thousands of people died. It was one of the biggest tank battles in world history. And as soon as it ended, Henry Kissinger got on a plane and began speaking to the Syrians. But now, with much smaller acts taking place, we won't speak to them. And that's untenable. The administration knows it. Bill Kristol knows it, which is why he's putting pressure on the administration by saying, go out there and bomb Syria. They're going to figure this one out. Condoleezza Rice is still only going to Israel right now, but eventually we're going to find her, I'm guessing and hoping, I suppose, we're going to find her in other Arab capitals as well.
And of course, the irony is that if, as David said, the U.S. is finding out in Iraq the hard way that overwhelming military power doesn't solve problems or doesn't always lead to the results that you anticipate, there's a real irony that the U.S. is... at least tacitly supporting Israel doing essentially the same thing.
All right, let's see if Dewey's still there. Hey, Dewey.
Hey. Early on you said you wanted to kind of forget about the religious aspect of this, but you, from the shores of the states here to Israel, this is a religious matter. If I'm not mistaken, I think Israel's location is the most historically holy site on this planet. Our president early on said with the war with Iraq that this was going to be a crusade. This sends shockwaves to this region of the Middle East. Let's not kid ourselves. This is about religion. Just look back at the oil embargo of the 70s was in retaliation to Israel bombing, I think Iran, but you cannot leave this religious aspect. And Rick, the only thing that's going to bring peace to this world is when we come together on the environmental problems of this planet.
Hey, Dewey, you always push on the environment, and I think that's a good thing, but I guess bombing the hell out of one country or another does affect the environment, but I'm going to let these guys talk about some of your religion questions early. Thanks, man.
Bye-bye.
Let me give you two examples about why we should be cautious about understanding this in purely religious terms, which an argument which I take to mean here are groups of people that have religious values, they have their books. Based upon their religious beliefs, they say, I cannot coexist with that other person. I'm going to go and try and kill them. Let's take two examples. First, go back to the 1980s. There's an Islamic revolution in Iran. Ayatollah Khomeini comes to power. Makes several aggressive comments about Israel. The presence of this Jewish state is an insult to Islam, and Jerusalem must be a Muslim city once again, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And all the time he's saying these religiously inflected, highly provocative statements, he's accepting arms from a country called Israel. We have to jog people's memory to go back to the Iran-Contra scandal. It was Israel that was the conduit for somewhere around $3 billion worth of weapons to Iran. And those weapons were incredibly important to the Iranian ability to withstand Iraqi attacks. Let's go back a few years earlier. 1982, Israel sends an invasion force into southern Lebanon to defeat the Palestine Liberation Organization, which has taken up residents there and which has come to terrorize the local Shi'i population. So when Israeli tanks cross the border and go to these Shi'i villages, the Shi'i population, which right now supports Hezbollah, welcomes the Israeli tanks. And the religious differences didn't matter. They liked being liberated from Palestinian, from PLO oppression. And it was only after Israel became the occupying force there that the Lebanese Shia turned against Israel and initiated their resistance movement. So, yes, religion plays a role. After all, we're talking about a Jewish state here. But no, it's not the case that people are solely driven by religious identity or religious beliefs. And in fact, quite often they think quite strategically. These are groups that want to accomplish certain goals, goals that would be absolutely recognizable to any American, regardless of that American's religious background or level of secularism. Sometimes they use religious symbols. Sometimes they draw on recruits who might themselves be somewhat more driven by religious beliefs. But, many of the players in these conflicts are actually themselves secular. Not the case with Hezbollah necessarily, but with lots of other players in the overall set of conflicts. It's simply not all about religion.
Very eloquently stated. I couldn't add much to it, except for the irony that David ended on, and that is that the Jewish state was established by resolutely secular Jews. I absolutely agree with what David said.
All right, it is 11:57 here on the Wake Up Call. WNRN Charlottesville and WNRS FM Sweetbriar, Amherst, Lynchburg. And let me thank 4-5 Fix for their support today. 4-5-Fix.com. If you have a home improvement project, there's another way to find a contractor. It's 4-5-Fix.com. From remodeling to repair projects, immediate no obligation estimates are available anytime. That's 4-5-Fix.com. The number 4, the number 5, and the word fix.com. All right, just a minute or so left, gentlemen. I guess, you look at the paper and you see the pictures on the front and Professor Rollner, we've just skimmed over the humanitarian issues involved, but you mentioned the dead bodies that are actually out there, whether we see them or whether we just read about them. But isn't this, it's sort of being treated as, and I asked this question in another fashion, it's sort of being treated as, oh, well, they're at it again. Because, my God, there's 25,000 people over there, 25,000 Americans over there, and they're sending a 700-passenger cruise liner to get them out. It just doesn't, and the other ones are taken out by helicopter. I'm waiting to see the photo of Vietnam where the last person climbs to the top of the building and gets out by helicopter to leave. It just doesn't seem like anybody except the two countries involved are taking this very seriously. Am I wrong about that? Should we, as Americans, get totally worked up about it? And I'm not talking about the humanitarian aspect, because while we should be, people could care less about Darfur unless you're actually having a conversation and you need to come across as an understanding person. That we can pick millions of topics where the right answer is to be humanitarian. And I'd like to think that everyone here in the studio today is humanitarian and needs to think of it that way. But we're not. You may be, Professor Waldner, that may be the top of your list, and I don't know whether it is anyone else's, but no one seems to be concerned other than, oh, look at that picture. One of the pictures in the USA Today caught my attention because it was so pretty. It was a nighttime shot of all the explosions going on. I was like, wow, that's good photography. How weird am I from everybody else, the average American?
Well, no, I think quite typical, and it's certainly the way that, there's a big role in terms of how the media represents issues to us. One of the things I'd like to come back to is that the humanitarian crisis, awful as it is in Lebanon, what the casualty figures are, 400, maybe 500 civilians.
Well, I took all the time, so you've got about 30 seconds.
That in Iraq, 30, 40, 50,000 Iraqis have died in the last year. That, again, the thing that has been sidelined by the Lebanese, the explosion of media interest in the Lebanon bombing campaign is what's going on in Gaza, and there are hundreds of people have been killed as well, and so there are just lots and lots of humanitarian crises around the world.
Professor,
no doubt we should be interested.
I actually think most people care more about the humanitarian side than you said, and I think you probably would agree ultimately. Maybe I'm wrong, but if you want to close on two words, three, oil and blowback, if you will. Oil, we have to care about the Middle East because it's an important supplier for world oil, and that affects the prices we pay and our standard of living. And blowback, because when people in the Middle East become convinced that Americans don't value their lives, some of them, a very small percentage, but some of them get very, very angry and decide to kill Americans as a response.
All right. I want to thank both of you for coming in today. It's much appreciated. A difficult topic, and we try and jam it in an hour. I took an extra minute of George Bell's time. Hopefully he'll forgive me next week. The Food Geek will be here next, boys and girls. We try not to get too crazy back-to-back weeks. Adios.
This has been your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN. The wake-up call is brought to you by The Hook, an innovative weekly from the people who really know the news on Newsstands Thursday. And by Tiger Fuel, serving the Charlottesville area with home heating oil and propane, Exxon gasolines, and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of the management, staff, or board of WNRN. You can contact Rick at abstractme@aol.com or at wnrn.rlc.net. The wake-up call is produced by Catherine Greiner. Tune in again next Sunday morning at 11 for the wake-up call, only on WNRN.